This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week, we're looking at Turkey. There's going to be a referendum there on Sunday. Critics say a yes vote would institutionalise the one-man rule of the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. In effect, create a democratic dictatorship. The government says the change is needed to solve the country's many ills, including a sagging economy and repeated terrorist attacks. So our question on The Briefing Room is, should we worry about Turkey? This weekend, there'll be a referendum in Turkey. It's been described as a moment when this strategically vital country stands poised between democracy and autocracy. In The Briefing Room, I'll be asking experts to tell me what the referendum is about, what's at stake, and who's likely to win. The first thing we need is some proper background. The BBC's Chris Morris has covered Turkey for years and has written a book about it, and we asked him to file an essay on Sunday's referendum.
On the face of it, the referendum is about changing a constitution written at the behest of generals who took power in a coup nearly 30 years ago. In truth, this is all about one man, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. I've been following his career for more than two decades now, and if you want to understand Sunday's referendum, you've got to understand Erdogan.
Bugün bir adam öldürüldü Tayyip.
Right on cue, they've just released a glowing dramatization of his life on the big screen.
Bizler hizmet aşkıyla yola çıkmış neferleriz.
He grew up in Kasımpaşa, a working-class neighborhood on the northern shores of Istanbul's Golden Horn. A tall, pious young man. His passions were football and politics. The football he played semi-professionally, the politics he's always played like a total pro. He was 26 when the generals took over in 1980, and politics was a dangerous business. The pro-Islamist parties he supported kept getting banned on the ground that they threatened Turkey's secular state. But he kept at it. Why is the West so scared of us, he said at the time. We're not extremists, we're a party of the middle ground. And Erdogan turned the opposition from the secular elite to his advantage, painting himself as an outsider, an underdog, a champion of the common man, in what is, in parts, a deeply religious country. It worked. By the mid-90s, he was mayor of Turkey's biggest city, Istanbul. And he proved himself to be a pragmatic and effective one, though he did raise eyebrows when he tried to ban alcohol from Istanbul's many cafes. So alarm bells were already ringing inside the establishment when, at this rally in 1997, he recited a famous nationalist poem. The minarets are our bayonets, the domes are helmets, the poem reads. The mosques are our barracks, and the faithful are soldiers. My reference is Islam, he told the crowd. If I'm not able to speak of this, what's the point in living? His supporters loved the way he was breaking taboos, but it was all too much for Turkey's fiercely secular system. He was convicted for inciting religious hatred, forced to resign as mayor, and sentenced to 10 months in jail. I was living in Turkey at the time, and it was clear that this was just a temporary setback. He would later tell me that his time in prison invigorated him. And once he was out, Erdogan set up a new pro-Islamist political party, the AKP, in English, the Justice and Development Party. Even here, though, there was double meaning. In Turkish, ak, ak, means pure or white, and within a few short years, Erdogan's party became the dominant force in Turkish politics. 2002, I was in Ankara when the AKP won a stunning election victory. Erdogan, Prime Minister, shouted the crowds. He couldn't take up the job because of his criminal conviction, because of that poem. But there was no doubt about who was in charge. He promised his party would govern for all Turks. Our party will respect the lifestyle of all our citizens, he declared. We'll step up efforts to join the European Union and integrate with the outside world. It felt like a moment of hope, a moment of real change. A court soon overturned the ban which prevented him holding public office. And in 2003, Tayyip Erdogan became a prime minister, determined to reform his country. The economy boomed, and more Turks than ever before had a real stake in it. Roads, schools and hospitals were built, and democratic reforms were pushed through parliament. Still, the old suspicions of Erdogan's motives lingered, a point I put to the Prime Minister when I interviewed him in 2004.
There still seem to be some people in this country, not a majority, but some people who mutter, oh, he's a fundamentalist, he's not to be trusted. What do you think you've got to do to persuade people?
We are fed up with this kind of accusation. First of all, we are not a party that's based on religion, and there is no way we can accept fundamentalism. We have always been opposed to extremism. I can tell you that there is an understanding in our party to keep away from any extremist ideas.
I remember thinking at the time, okay, you probably deserve the benefit of the doubt. Trust but verify. And Western leaders, for the most part, believed him. Here was the man who would prove that Islam and democracy could coexist. I watched him tour capitals trying to resolve the Cyprus issue, the long-running war against Kurdish rebels, and other disputes with Turkey's neighbours. And in December 2004, I was there in Brussels when, after years of knocking at the door, it was Tayyip Erdogan who signed up to the opening of negotiations on Turkey joining the EU. Yes, he said, Turkey can be a bridge, culturally or otherwise, between East and West, and we can set an example to 1.5 billion Muslims around the world. It was easy to be positive, but was this in retrospect a turning point? The negotiations soon hit roadblocks as the political winds in Europe began to change. Erdogan became increasingly frustrated, angry, insulted. And at home, even though he kept on winning elections, freely and fairly, I must add, he did so by demonising the other side and cracking down on dissent. Fast forward to 2013, protests in the heart of Istanbul, in a place called Gezi Park. Many liberal Turks who'd supported Erdogan as he reduced the power of the military in Turkish politics had finally had enough.
We don't want this government. They are dictator.
There were extraordinary scenes in the city I used to call home. I filed this report while wearing a gas mask.
We're on the streets just off Taksim Square, and the police have just fired tear gas and used water cannon to push a group of protesters back up this street. And it means that Tayyip Erdogan, the Prime Minister, has achieved his initial objective of clearing the park and clearing the square. But he's done nothing to assuage the anger of protesters who've been demonstrating here and on other roads all around this square as they try to reach this symbolic location.
For weeks, the international media focused on the drama in Istanbul. Many spoke of revolution. But I travelled away from the whistles and the tear gas guns into the other Turkey, Erdogan's Turkey, out on the vast Anatolian plain. Even here, there is a small, defiant show of support for the protesters in Istanbul and elsewhere. But in Kayseri, it feels like a minority view. Tayyip Erdogan is absolutely right in the way he's dealing with this, Osman says. Everything the government does is for the good of our country. Süleyman says he's never actually voted for Erdogan, but the Prime Minister's party works really hard. Turkey has nothing to do with dictatorship. Everyone can do what they like. Increasingly, though, that was no longer true. Erdogan became more paranoid and more intolerant. Journalists and other critics were routinely imprisoned, and opposition was portrayed as tantamount to treason. But it wasn't all one-way traffic. Tapes of phone calls were leaked, allegedly of Erdogan doing shady deals, an attempt to undermine his image as Mr. Clean. He denied it all, but politics became ever more fractious. And by now, Erdogan had another massive challenge to confront. The Syrian civil war was raging on Turkey's southern border. Turkey was getting sucked in, sheltering millions of refugees, and then protecting and training some of the rebels. Perhaps it was inevitable that there'd be blowback. Erdogan's safe, prosperous Turkey was increasingly under threat. Hundreds were killed in bomb attacks by so-called Islamic State or by Kurdish militants. It felt like chaos was closing in on Turkey's most powerful man. Dirty tricks, protests, bombings. Erdogan responded by lashing out at enemies real and imagined. But then, in July last year, he had a genuinely close shave. An extraordinary night, an attempted military coup in a NATO country. Parliament was bombed, and Erdogan himself narrowly escaped capture and possible assassination. From his mobile phone, he made a dramatic video call to a TV station live on air, imploring Turks to take to the streets to defend democracy. They listened. People power stopped the coup, and Erdogan, now president, survived. Conspiracy theorists say he organised the coup himself to bolster his own position, but I don't believe that. I think there was a genuine attempt to remove him from power. Still, ever the opportunist, Erdogan called the coup a gift from God and swiftly set about purging the army, the judiciary and the universities of alleged plotters. Turkey's been in a state of emergency ever since. Tens of thousands of people have been arrested and thousands have been charged. And it was in this febrile atmosphere that Erdogan launched the attempt to redraw the constitution and place more power in his own hands. It's been a bitter campaign which has spilled over Turkey's borders. Gone are the days of warm relations with Europe. The president has been reduced to name-calling. Konuşturmamakla Almanya'daki oyların evet değil de hayır çıkacağını mı zannediyorsunuz? Ey Almanya! You think that by stopping us from speaking, he said recently, the votes of Turks in Germany will favour the no vote and not the yes vote? Germany, you have no notion of democracy. Your practices are no different from the Nazi practices of the past. His authoritarian streak is becoming his defining characteristic, but Tayyip Erdogan also has a mandate. He wins elections with a share of the vote that most European politicians can only dream of. Early in his career, though, Erdogan once famously said, "Democracy is like a streetcar. You ride it as far as you can, and then you get off." Now, many of his critics at home and abroad fear that Turkey's president may be getting close to that final destination.
Chris Morris there. Joining me in the briefing room now are Zia Meral, who's the resident fellow at the Centre for Historical Analysis and Conflict Research at Sandhurst, and Ferdevs Robinson, formerly of the BBC's Central Asian Service, and now a freelance writer and Turkey blogger. Ferdevs, if I could ask you first, what is the actual question on the ballot paper?
There is no question on the ballot paper. On ballot paper, you have two colours, white and light brown, and it says yes and no. So when you go to a polling station, you are supposed to know what the question is, which is basically, do you accept 18 articles to be changed in Turkey's existing constitution? but your choice on your paper is only yes and no.
So actually you rely entirely upon the campaign to tell you what the issue is that you're voting yes or no on. There's nothing in the ballot paper to tell you.
Absolutely, and that's one of the biggest worries that I have, because there was very little public debate about the content of the changes and the nature of changes and what it might mean for Turkey's future. 18 articles that are changing are quite complex, and they will transform Turkey from what it is now. The campaign has been run under emergency law.
What does that actually mean? What difference does that make?
That means, first of all, tens of thousands of people in jail, pending trial. It means more than 150 journalists in jail. It means restrictions on public gatherings, restricts freedom of speech. It's restrictive.
Zia Meral, if I can turn to you about what the referendum confers. Is it correct to characterise this as essentially a huge increase of centralised power?
Yes and no. In some sense, it's very true. It gathers executive powers into a single office in such a way that no previous government in Turkish history have really enjoyed. Shifts the power from Prime Minister's office into the presidency, blurs the lines between the executive and judicial branch, and provides the president with unprecedented power to appoint high-ranking judges, as well as his own ministers, as well as his own vice presidents, and completely demolishes the office of the Prime Minister, gives him more power over the parliament. He can call for elections, he can abolish the parliament, and limits the powers of the parliament in its legislative capacity, as well as the capacity to bring a potential crime committed by any president in the future into account.
Now, you said yes and no, so that was the yes bit. What was the no bit?
The no bit in the sense that illiberal democracy has been in Turkish history all throughout its 100 years of history. The Turkish state has always been all-encompassing. Its economy, its private investors and political actors have always overlapped. Media ownership has always been a powerful political asset as well too. Yet at the same time, it is also very true to say that now the President Erdogan is enjoying unprecedented level of powers already because of the state of emergency. He's able to pass single legislative decisions on his own. Now, a lot of it is basically enshrining it and protecting what is already enjoying it. And that altercation of the whole system and giving one man that much of rule is new.
So what you're saying is it's embodying in the constitution the powers that Erdogan has effectively taken already outside the constitution.
Since the coup attempt, because of the state of emergency, yes.
OK, but how do the supporters of President Erdogan himself see it all? We've had one of his senior advisers send us a memo from the presidential palace, and here it is.
Hello, my name is Gülnur Aybet. I'm a professor of international relations at Yıldız Technical University in Istanbul, and I'm also senior advisor to the president of Turkey. Here's my memo to the briefing room. There's been a considerable amount of anti-Western, anti-European feeling in an unprecedented scale across all spectrums, not just those who vote for the government. And it's twofold. The first reason is Western reactions to the attempted military coup we had here 9 months ago. Instead of any empathy coming from our Western allies, we were just leveled a lot of criticism with regards to the arrests that went on before we actually got any sympathy. And when you think about people who had actually given their lives on the streets to uphold democracy in this country, it's actually coming across as a very callous reaction from the West. The second thing is there's a large Turkish diaspora in Europe. In previous elections here in Turkey, ministers and politicians from all sides have been able to go and speak to the public there and hold rallies. Well, some European countries openly supported the no vote by allowing no campaigners to campaign without any hindrance, while some European countries refused entry to Turkish ministers. In fact, one Turkish minister was detained and deported. And for this to happen from one NATO country to another is really quite unspeakable. This is something that Turkey's Western allies really need to think about very carefully. This rising anti-Western sentiment could have an effect on NATO, Turkey's position in NATO, and also its future membership in the EU. Because as the anti-Western sentiment grows, politicians at the end of the day are answerable to their publics. They will actually mirror what the public wants of them. And if the public feeling is increasingly anti-Western, then politicians will eventually have to follow a similar line.
Well, that was slightly chilly. Do you agree with Professor Abet's analysis, Zia Mirel?
I think we are definitely seeing a drop in ambitions for EU accession across the public in different segments. There's a wide disillusionment, and that's worrying. Some of it is politically led. In other words, President Erdogan has been quite heavy against EU for a couple of years now. Some of that is that kind of frustration in the public that we've been knocking at the European doors for so many years. Nothing is opening. And in the coup attempt, in fact, Britain stood out in its actual sympathy towards Turkey immediately, rather than a lot of European leaders have taken a couple of weeks and months to understand the gravity of what happened. Can President Erdogan call off relations with NATO? Not really. And NATO is a different category. That's why the AK Party government is very careful about their comments over NATO. And there isn't really a sense of any divergence from NATO. But could Turkey call off accession to EU? There are worrying signs of it that it could actually happen.
I suppose what people are more worried about is the idea that Turkey will orient itself towards Putin as a consequence. That's the sort of threat that seemed to be held out. Ferdinand Robinson, is this a realistic threat?
I don't think it is a realistic threat. Turkey has a difficult relationship with Russia. Turkey's relationship with Russia, out of necessity, seems calmer than its relations and the rhetoric used against Europe and even to United States. But underlying problems are just as great, if not greater.
So, in other words, you don't take that, Ziamara, you don't take that particular notion seriously. Because the one thing which you observe is if you're going to call the Germans Nazis, it's a kind of rhetorical position. It's quite difficult to climb down from.
It is. I think even last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of signs from Ankara that after the referendum, there'll be some sort of normalization with tensions with Europe. I don't think Turkish political actors realize the gravity of the words that comes out in this process and actually the bridges that they've already burned. Given where European politics are, the tide against Turkey is really strong, not just accession, but also a lot of strategic issues that impacts both of them. For example, customs union agreement needs to be renegotiated, and given where things are, I don't think there's any appetite in half of Europe to give any compromises or any positive points towards Turkey.
I could add something. Turkey needs Europe as much as Europe needs Turkey. It's one of Turkey's biggest trade partners. But on the other hand, Turkey is also, I think, probably quite glad to get rid of some of the obligations that it has towards Europe. European Court of Human Rights will be flooded with so many applications as a result of some of the legal issues that we are facing in Turkey now. So we may find it may come to a point where Turkey would be glad to get rid of that pressure.
So we were talking there mostly about human rights issues. Let's move on to what we expect to happen. What are the polls showing right now, Ferdinand Robinson?
Polls are not very reliable in Turkey. A lot of them are not as independent as we would like them to be, but also people tend to be quite scared of expressing their intentions. So I would not trust them very much. But on the other hand, some polls, if they are coming from the government side, are indicating that it will be a resounding yes vote. And from the opposition side, they think it's going to be maybe not a big difference between the two sides, but definitely a no vote. A few months ago, if you asked me this question, I would say the way that the campaign was run, not very freely and fairly, the government side would have the upper hand. But right now, I think they've overdone it. Even some of the governing party supporters are now asking questions about the wisdom of the changes that's been proposed.
Very quickly, Zia Mirel, on that, is that also your impression, or do you have a different one?
I think there's a higher chance that Erdogan will win than he will lose. Probably a yes vote with a small margin is very plausible.
And there's no danger, is there, of the vote being rigged?
I think in particular localities, irregularities pop up every now and then, but overall calculations kind of give a reliable confidence on the vote cutting. The question is the fairness of the process. As Firdevs has pointed out, we see a lot of fear, we see a lot of limitations on different views being heard, and a lot of Kurdish politicians are in jail, etc. But at the same time, the counting of the votes, with the exception of a few localities here and there, tends to be by and large reliable.
Let's look at the other possibility. The possibility that he loses. What would happen then?
I think in the immediate future, you'll see a series of provisions passed to patch up some of the crucial powers that he wants to enshrine, and then an early election to strengthen the government, and possibly a take two.
A second referendum, possibly, slightly less ambitious.
Or bit-by-bit constitutional changes that actually provides a lot of these de facto powers within law, but still keeps this dual head of prime minister and president.
So he wouldn't take no for an answer?
No, not really. The stakes are really high. They will not let it go. So if it's a no, it won't be. We'll wake up. All of a sudden, a return to kind of pre-2008 democracy, reform, EU-focused agenda. It will be a very patchy, precarious, politically extremely charged process.
Fedez Robinson, what about the opposition in all this? I mean, all our discussion so far has been really about one man, Erdogan. Is there any rival to him? Is there any effective opposition figure?
People assume there isn't, but there are a lot of politicians in Turkey, and if they were to be given a fair chance to compete, you could get good political parties and leaders to emerge. But the problem is that Turkish society in general like strong leaders, and they like good communicators. And Mr. Erdogan is probably one of the best when it comes to being a strong leader and a good communicator.
Zimmeral.
I think since 2013, we see how Erdogan steered the entire party in such a way that the possibility of somebody from within the party or some of its initial founders emerging to challenge him is a bit unlikely at the moment. That still means that in the near future, President Erdogan is going to be the most important and powerful political actor.
What we really need to watch is what happens in AKP, because if Erdogan loses, then I think the AKP might seriously split, and a new search for a new party and a leader will begin very quickly.
Zimmeral, and if it's very, very close, either way, I mean really, really wafer thin close, will the losing side accept the result?
Not really. I think the polarization is really real. I think stakes are high for everybody. Concerns are very real. Possibilities are really real. I think in the near future, we are going to see a very unstable and precarious Turkey, not only in its security, but also in its political tensions, but also in its economy.
Do you agree with that, Fedez Robinson?
Yes,
we should worry.
I do. I do worry. I think we should worry. And while we worry, I think we should keep the pressure on Turkey to return to a sort of at least a minimum level of democracy. I would also say don't abandon Turkey, because Turkey has still at least probably 50% of people who really want a liberal democracy of a kind for their country.
Okay, to sum up, this referendum is a big change. It will centralise powers for the presidency. He will probably win. But even if he does, there's going to be a very difficult situation that Turkey inherits. That makes it difficult for the rest of us. And jollity all round, really. My thanks to Chris Morris and Gulna Aybet, who you heard earlier, and to my guests here in the briefing room, Zia Meral and Fedevs Robinson. My producer for this episode was Neil Rozelle, and research was by Beth Sagar-Fenton. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, you might like a BBC podcast called The Inquiry. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about this series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or ratings on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.